This special edition of Midori House from the Frieze Masters Art Fair was first broadcast on the 15th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from the third edition of Frieze Masters in London's Regent's Park. I'm Robert Bound. On today's show, we'll be meeting the head honcho of this classy art fair. Victoria Siddle will swoop by. We'll speak to that eminent art writer, Dr. Sarah Thornton, about what's caught her ever vigilant eyes and ears this year. We'll get a little tour with the Museum of Everything's James Brett. You know him. What is he like?
Large, very naked, slightly disproportioned, white women with staring glassy eyes and cascading golden hair.
And Jim Dempsey of Corbett versus Dempsey Gallery in Chicago will come in to tell us about his 70s booth and why he's wearing that kippa tie. That's all coming up in the next hour here on a special edition of Midori House, beaming to you all the way from London's Regent's Park this fine autumn evening. Oh, it's raining. We've almost got too much to fit into the next hour, but before we do, here is Suzanne Chislett with the latest news.
American health authorities have confirmed a second nurse who cared for a sick Liberian man in Texas has tested positive for Ebola. The care worker is now in isolation, but it's emerged that a day before reporting symptoms, the nurse flew from Cleveland to Dallas. Other people on the plane are now being traced. Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings says despite a second transmission of the virus inside the United States, people shouldn't panic.
The only way that we are going to beat this is person by person, moment by moment, detail by detail. We have those protocols in place, the city and county, working closely with the CDC and the hospital.
The pro-democracy supporter who was seen in a video being beaten and kicked by police in Hong Kong has said he's taking legal advice. The incident happened earlier as authorities moved to clear a street which had been barricaded by the demonstrators. Around 45 people were arrested and Ken Sang was seen in the video being dragged around a corner by what appeared to be plainclothes police.
You should have seen the TV footage of a number of police officers brutally assaulting me while I was retained and entering defenseless. Prior to that, I had already been assaulted and was later assaulted yet again in the police station.
US-led forces have intensified airstrikes against Islamic State fighters threatening Kurds on Syria's Turkish border. 21 attacks have been carried out against the militants near the town of Kobani, amid fears their presence is destabilizing Turkey. Washington says the coalition action appears to have slowed the IS advance, but has cautioned the situation remains fluid. Russia's ruble has plunged to all-time lows against the dollar and the euro, breaking through psychologically important levels against both currencies. The ruble's been under pressure because of a risk aversion to Russian assets following sanctions imposed by the European Union and United States of Moscow's role in the Ukraine crisis. In Ireland, the government has decided to close a tax loophole which allowed multinationals to save billions of dollars. The EU and US have both criticised the structure, which allowed companies, including Google and Apple, to channel untaxed revenues to an Irish subsidiary. It then paid the money to another company registered in Ireland, but tax resident elsewhere. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has outlined ambitious plans for oil and gas exploration in coastal waters. In a speech in Durban, he said as many as 9 billion barrels of crude and vast quantities of natural gas could be discovered. 30 exploration wells are set to be drilled in the next 10 years. A proposal for London to follow the lead of cities like New York and Hong Kong by banning smoking in parks and open spaces has received a cool welcome from the mayor of the British capital. Boris Johnson says the call, which came in a report he commissioned to try to improve public health in the city, takes bossiness too far. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Suzanne. It is 18:05 here at London's Regent's Park. You're tuned into Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. We're at Frieze Masters. We'll be back in just a jiffy.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Berlin.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are tuned into Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bound. This is a special edition of Midori House coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent's Park. Who better to kick off the show with than Frieze Masters director Victoria Siddle? Victoria, thanks for taking 5, maybe 10 minutes out of what is clearly a nutty schedule for you to come on the show.
It's a pleasure, and it is indeed a nutty schedule.
It is a nutty schedule, right?
Yes.
You're like the ultimate squirrel.
It just doesn't get nuttier, but there's just so much going on in London this week.
I like the fact that Monocle 24's sort of flagship show is such a draw for you. You walked in and said, as long as I've got a glass of water and a seat, then I'm fine. This is
glasses of water and seats have extremely high currency this week.
They do. And we walk in, and we walked into the fair this afternoon, and we felt like a lot of confidence bouncing off your sexy grey walls.
Thank you.
This year. I think it's one of those things, before we turned on the microphones, we talked about not a lot has changed, but I guess you've refreshed things a little bit.
Absolutely,
If things are a little different from last year, maybe we should let our listeners in on that secret, how things have changed.
The sexy grey walls you mentioned are designed by wonderful architect Annabelle Seldorf, mm-hmm. and what she's done really beautifully is create the best possible and most elegant backdrop for fantastic art. And so really what it is that changes each year is the work that you see here. And that's what makes the fair great and exciting, I think. And the galleries have really pulled the stops out this time, and I'm sure that's what you noticed as you walked through the door, is you just see quite extraordinary numbers of amazing works of art, spanning 7,000 years, I've worked
that's
out.
That's the thing, okay.
Yeah.
Are you going to give us? Should we put two pins in that map and see where we can go?
Okay,
what's
so
the
we
oldest
have,
thing that we've got here?
As far as I know, the oldest piece is it's a 7,000-year-old Neolithic idol. It's 10 centimeters high. It's on Rupert Wace's stand.
Okay,
and it was made in 5,000 BC.
That's the map. Oh yeah, I bought that. Okay, next.
but then you also have, there's a Richard Prince joke painting in the fair as well.
Yeah.
So I would say that's a pretty broad spectrum. The great thing is there's also everything in between and from all over the world. So you can see Japanese art, Korean art, as well as the best of everything from all over Europe, Arte Povera, you see Monohar. It's really incredibly diverse.
And what are your sort of touchstones the first fair was 3 years ago, the first Frieze Masters was 3 years ago, and it looked nice and it looked elegant. You obviously had your visual identity kind of down pat, mm-hmm. then, but what have been the touchstones? Which places do you visit? I love when I'm looking at gunmetal grey walls, maybe they're battleship grey, I don't know. We can argue about the adjective for the greyness.
I was thinking dove, but
dove grey. I'm thinking about places like the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, mm. and places like this that were beautifully put together, sort of almost like bijouterie, the way that things are executed and lit for sale. What are the places? Do you go to churches and check out what kind of wattage of light bulb they have? How do you get the visual identity of the fair like this?
It's funny you mentioned the Rijksmuseum, because I went to the opening, the reopening after sort of the 10-year renovation, and the one thing I was really struck by, apart from the extraordinary art, was the lighting. Like they just got the lighting spot on, and I think these things really matter when you want people to spend a whole day looking at art in a fair. And I mentioned Annabelle Seldorf. That's what she's brilliant at, actually. It's just getting the environment just right. And the challenge we have, obviously, is that everything is mixed within the fair. So you don't have a section for old masters and a section for modern, a section for ancient. So you will see a gallery showing, the Richard Prince joke paintings, as I mentioned, next to a gallery showing, and we have a Rembrandt in the fair, and then you'll have somebody showing Native American tribal art and African sculpture, and so be able to juxtapose those throughout the fair. The architecture is really important to making that work, essentially.
And that's the thing. I mean, sitting where we are, we're outside the auditorium for the Frieze Masters talks. We'll talk about the talks in a minute, I can see a Kosov, I can see a Sean Scully up here, mm-hmm. but like one booth further down, there are these... They're not called Philosopher's Stones, are they?
Called Scholar Rocks.
Scholar Rocks.
Scholar Rocks.
Philosopher's Stones are something
they
else.
They were contemplated by Chinese scholars. And so they're these extraordinary rocks that have actually been formed into wonderful shapes by nature, I believe. And scholars would contemplate them in ancient China.
Hewn by the wind itself.
And the wind and the rain and all sorts, yeah. But they're rather wonderful things. And they're on a stand next to, I'm sure you've noticed, Heli Namad's stand, which is possibly the most ambitious art
stand. It's the elephant in the room, isn't it?
Everyone's talking about it. The stand has been mobbed with people. It's kind of a stand that's about the sort of nostalgia of collecting. It's a film set actually built by a film set designer, and it's essentially he's imagined a collector living in Paris in 1968 and created his apartment in the art fair stand, and it's piled up with copies of Paris Match from the 60s. There are photographs everywhere, there are extraordinary art books everywhere. It's a mess basically, but the art on the walls is absolutely extraordinary.
And it's nice hearing people, the conversations people are having around that, because it's sort of in a corner booth as well.
Yeah.
So people are kind of stuck in there. And it is kind of like looking at, people can be nosy.
They can.
You can look into
the guy's bedroom,
really like,
and you
possibly.
Can see his bedroom is stuffed with Giacometti and Fontana and Dubuffet, and you know it's
Aunt
supposed
Basil.
To be. It's like looking inside someone's brain,
or
at least inside someone's imagination, and it's kind of a wonderful experience.
There's some other wonderful things. I took a trip down to Douglas Ellis and had a look at
Donald Ellis. Yes. So Donald shows the Native American tribal art that I mentioned.
Which is amazing, isn't that stuff?
And
fascinating.
He has actually he's actually sold some of that work to artists as well this year. He has these ledger drawings, they're called, and they were done by sort of Native Americans in these ledger books that they were given by Americans. They're like school books, they're like ruled school books. These amazing drawings.
And these are the warriors that were of a social status in their a social standing within their tribe to be given the pens and the wherewithal to make this art. So it's a really interesting, there's a strange structure.
And then he has these
it.
Sort of leather saddlebags as well. Apparently the men did the drawings and the women painted the saddlebags. And the saddlebags were painted with these wonderful abstract patterns. And I mean, I would highly recommend going and having a look at that because it's work you don't normally see.
No, it's gorgeous that. And it's I feel like I could ask you a question about pretty much any of the works here, any of the galleries have got, and you know. But presumably one of the joys for you is walking around and being told some wonderful story by an art dealer.
Absolutely.
And not knowing anything about anything until you go and see it. Right?
And that's really the joy of the fair, which I would highly recommend doing for anyone visiting, is go and talk to the dealers on the stands, because they're incredibly passionate about what they show. And you may also be talking to one of the people in the world who knows most about the art on their stands.
Yeah.
You know, they really know it inside out. They're true experts, and so they're very happy to have a conversation about the work.
And we said that we're sort of cheek by jowl with Frieze Masters Talks, which is the big auditorium where various august people have been shooting the breeze. Today we had William Kentridge. Tomorrow we've got Phillida Barlow. Edmund Duval is on the last day here. That presumably, this is one of those nice parts of the fair that kind of gives a bit of, well, gives even more, I guess, weight to it. It gives a little bit more of an intellectual thing. People can also shoot off. And do you know what they have in there? Apparently, I think they've got seats and water.
So they do, I've actually been to two talks today for this.
Yeah,
but not just for the seats and water, I should say. Content was excellent.
Yeah.
It's more than just what you described, because the talks are, I think they reflect the whole contemporary nature of what we're trying to do and who we are as Frieze. It was very important from the beginning that we took a very contemporary approach to historical art with this fair. And so engaging contemporary artists to talk about old masters and Renaissance sculpture and Wunderkammer, as Edmund Duval will be, is really, really important. So William Kentridge spoke today and he talked about Michelangelo. He was talking about works in the Courtauld Gallery. He talked about Michelangelo. He talked about Manet. He talked about Degas. And it gives you this fascinating insight into both the historical works they're talking about and also into the artist's brain. So I would highly recommend watching this. They'll actually all be online. All the 3 years worth are all online, free of charge.
We can direct our listeners to that. They should check out that stuff. And it's impossible to make a choice here. I mean, but if you had to supermarket sweep at Victoria's Siddle, what would go home in your handbag?
Gosh, let's see what photographs I've taken on my phone. It's my fantasy art collection, you see. it ranges from a Solowit wall drawing to a Ligier Pape sculpture to a Jean Tanguy machine to a medieval stone head to some Native American masks. To a Max Ernst, to a Boetti, to an Egon Schiele drawing, Romari Bearden painting, a Gauguin. I mean, I could go on, but you get the picture.
Christmas has just come early.
If anyone's listening.
Victoria, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to let you get off to your party.
Thank you.
It is 8:15 here in London, slightly autumnal and rainy Regent's Park. Victoria, we'll see you same time, same place next year, possibly.
Thank you.
It's Midori House coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair. We'll be back in a sec.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent's Park. Yesterday, we had a lot of hubbub around us here in our studio, our sort of radio booth in the corner of the Frieze Contemporary Fair. This year, you might be able to, you can hear a pin drop. You could hear a painting fall off a very nice gunmetal grey wall. It's a little bit more of a quieter vibe. We've been out and about. We've been touring around the art fair. Our next guest is the art writer Sarah Thornton. Before we go to Sarah, Monocle's Gaia Lutz has been out and about. She's been up to the Skarstedt Gallery, where she spoke to the director, Bonner Montague.
We like the position very much, obviously, because it gives us an opportunity to see people as they're coming in. And the fair is always a very good opportunity for us to meet many clients with whom we're in regular contact, but to see them in one place and bring artworks, which we would like to show them here. Frieze Masters is a fair, as you know, which has a particular focus. Everyone is required to bring historical works, and as a gallery that shows artists who are still working in some cases, we are fortunate enough to have wonderful examples of their works from the early stages in their career. So when we decide what we're going to bring to the fair, we start thinking about which pieces in particular we would like to show with that consideration in mind.
And can you exemplify with some pieces?
Well, this particular booth this year, we were thinking very much about artists who were working with text and also with portraits, because in some cases, some of the text pieces we have also have strong portraits. So the Barbara Kruger piece, for instance, Perpetual Insomnia is one of those pieces. We've had fantastic work with Richard Prince's with the text there from the White Joke paintings, possibly one of the best White Joke paintings from 1994. And we always try and put the pieces together in a way where it could be like an exhibition, where it could be a room in a museum, and give people a chance to see the work in the best possible way.
And business-wise, how important is this week, Frieze Masters, for the gallery? Not only, obviously, for sales, but for recognition and reaching a wider audience?
Art fairs are always important for us. There are certain key art fairs, and I would say that Basel, obviously, in Switzerland is one of them, and Frieze Masters certainly is becoming one. There are a lot of things happening at London at the time of the fair. So you have the auctions taking place, you have Frieze Art Fair, which shows the younger artists, established but younger artists, and also wonderful exhibitions taking place at all of the major museums. So it's a wonderful time for people to be in London.
It's a wonderful time for people to be in London. That was Bonna Montague speaking to Gaia Lutz a little earlier. And now that we've had the insider's look at the fair, it's time to widen the view. Sarah Thornton is here. She's the author of 33 Artists in Three Acts. And you were on the show a couple of weeks ago, on the Culture Show a couple of weeks ago, talking about that great new book of yours. But this art fair, Sarah, kind of reminds me of your former book, 7 Days in the Art World, about the big events of the art world, the magnets that draw people towards them. What's your reading of Masters and maybe the whole Frieze shebang this year?
I think Frieze has become more masterful in creating mega event.
Yeah.
And the addition of Frieze Masters, I think it's at this point, the second fair is looking fantastic and has such a broad range of work. I particularly like this spotlight section where you find lesser known modernist artists, and it's kind of very cool and hip and young at the same time as being in a fair called Frieze Masters.
It's amazing. It is kind of, I guess it's the sort of range of it, but there's the confidence of it. I was speaking to somebody earlier on, and I was sort of saying, you know, does it sort of take the pressure off when you look at art that isn't for sale? You look at it in a different way, but here it kind of feels a little bit, we feel like we're in maybe 100 little mini museums part of the time, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Rembrandt may be selling for $48.5 million, but that's kind of like not being on sale at all for me.
But it is, it's that thing, and I guess it's there. We were talking to Victoria Siddle all about how they put the space together, the lighting, the grey walls, the kind of creating the vibe, the thickness of the carpet, I guess. There's a bit more ply on it than there is at the contemporary
a
fair.
A huge improvement. I love the acoustics over here. Actually, I prefer Frieze Masters to the main fair.
Yeah.
The main fair is more cluttered, it's noisier, it's harder to take to really appreciate brand new things in that kind of environment. I actually am enjoying the familiarity of big brand names over here.
Well, I guess there's that thing of the art here is all, I guess, at its sort of newest. It's 50 years old maybe, or 40 years old. Kind of. You're making a face.
I think that's right. That's absolutely right. I think there's a lot of work from the 1970s here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, vintage, modernist master, or actually what you'd call contemporary master.
Contemporary master.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's not an elegant phrase, but...
I wouldn't mind some. All we can do, Sarah Thornton, is live up to that phrase, contemporary master. That's what we all need. But there's a sense, obviously, that most of the works, maybe all of the works here in this tent at Frieze Masters have kind of passed the test. They've passed into the canon. They get a tick in their box. I mean, I guess that is the thing. You can walk around here reliably and find something. Find a genuine master, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's some terrific art over at the Younger Fair, and some very established galleries over there, like David Zwirner and Gagosian and Hauser and Vert, who have interestingly stands here at Frieze Masters and also over there, just showing different wares.
Yeah, it's a different. It's a funny thing. I wonder. I think there's some interesting phone calls that go back and forth between the Masters Fair, the Listen here and the Zwirner Gallery here and there, having sort of a foot in both camps. I think that's an interesting thing. I hope there's a bit of friendly competition within the galleries themselves to see, who can work out some decent sales from these fairs. Right?
I mean, it's really interesting. The financial outlay for New York galleries nowadays, if they have a stand at the main fair, they have a stand at Frieze Masters, and increasingly they're opening up a gallery in London for the market that seems to be centered here. It's an extremely expensive month.
It is.
You hope they're selling some art.
Exactly, and that's before you've shelled out your 48.5 million on the Rembrandt set. Come on. And we then talking about New York galleries coming here. Marion Goodman opened last week on Golden Square.
Beautiful
in Soho
space.
Which is an amazing space. She opened with the Gerhard Richter show, which is, you know, this is sort of the bluest of the blue chip kind of chaps rolling into town. You mentioned David Zwirner, he's already been here for a little while. Should we be over the argument of London versus New York? Are we on a level playing field? Has London raced ahead, I wonder?
It's a tough question. I would say the market is still headquartered in New York. There's no doubt about it. There's many more galleries. There's a lot more square footage. The auctions have much higher values. But London is getting stronger. And in a globalized world in which the Middle East and Asia and Russia have climbed on board, you know, it may be that London is the way forward.
But the
critical mass in New York is still greater.
And we mentioned the name of your book, and we mentioned the name of your book before at 7 Days in the Art World. That was all about art events. That was all about these happenings.
Yeah.
I just wanted to come back to that for a second. Openings like the Marion Goodman, events like this, that they must be interesting things. They must be balm to a writer such as yourself that likes to kind of get to the nub of these events. Have you seen any good material this week?
Well, I mean, actually, the thing that struck me yesterday was the number of reporters who kept stopping me to ask me what I was wearing.
Oh, really?
Which has not happened to me in the past.
I really like your shoes.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us what you're wearing. Yeah. Sarah Thornton, what are you wearing?
I've got some Stella McCartney shoes. It seemed to attract a lot of attention. But I think the degree to which Frieze is on the radar of the fashion pages and the fact that American Vogue has, you know, a photographer and a reporter running around the fair that certainly did not happen in the first few years of the Frieze Fair.
It's a sign of the art times, isn't it?
And the fact that art has become so fashionable, and, you know, which is both alarming to some and also something that's terrific for the art world. You know, it used to be a very small, excluding world. It's getting bigger. If fashion brings a greater audience to contemporary art, then that's no bad thing. You just hope art doesn't go the way of fashion and become so seasonal that you're really not interested in looking at the painting you bought last week or last season.
It's an expensive habit for it to become so transient, right?
Exactly. I mean, when you look at some younger emerging artists, you wonder, you think maybe it is the equivalent to a new pair of shoes. But that's what's exciting about contemporary art. You know, 90% of it will go by the wayside. 95%, perhaps 99%, is, you know, being the person to find the 5% of contemporary art, which is really going to stand the test of time and be intriguing and intellectually stimulating in the long term.
And talking about artists themselves, it seems that, I mean, we can see why we've talked before about why artists don't like coming to art fairs. This Masters is different because, as we say, everything has got the kind of the seal of approval. Everything is old and is a master. So I've seen quite a few people bouncing around today. This could have been a chapter in your new book, I guess. Cornelia Parker bouncing around like a newly born foal looking at things and all day.
Really?
Yeah. Very nice to see. And we've seen some artists buying works. I think we were talking about the Native American works on Donald Ellis's stand.
Yes,
I think Julian Opie had a look at some of those. Just kind of nice to see artists looking at art rather than people looking at artists looking at art, right?
Well, I think that 10 years ago, artists were not expected to be at art fairs. It might be a taint against their reputation. It might make them look like they were too interested
too
in the market,
yeah.
Too commercial, too profit motivated. But I think that the market has become such a huge monster that is no longer a threat, and certainly no longer a threat to the Cornelia Parkers of the world.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they can handle that.
Yeah.
And I guess we're going to... We started with Victoria Siddle. We asked her what was in a shopping basket. What's caught your eye, sir?
Oh my God, well, lots and lots of things. I mean, I really like the Peter Vibels on the Anita Becker stand. There's some really interesting vintage video work from the early 70s, black and white kind of body performances.
Have you got a VHS player still?
No, and actually I was kind of wondering where those, it's a good thing those televisions they're using still work.
Yeah.
Know, I don't know, those big boxy Sonys.
I was going to say, there's kids walking around here going, geez, you know, TVs used to have backs.
Right? Yeah.
It's a strange thing. And I always like these. I think video art is always displayed on these funny, these boxy TVs. There's something about it, right? They're like an old-fashioned monitor.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what's in your shopping basket. I can't interest you in a 12th century cat sculpture on the Sam Fogg stand. I think he sold that, so I think maybe that's gone.
Oh, what a drag.
What a drag.
I'm a big cat fan.
It's a bit heavy to bring home. The noise you can hear is the sound of us being kicked out, but not for half an hour. What are we going to do? It's 18:30 here. I'm going to try and get the time right this time. We're going to thank Sarah Thornton. Thank you very much for joining us. We've got plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll take a tour of Frieze Masters with James Brett from the Museum of Everything. Easy for me to say. And we'll find out what the exhibitors at the Thomas Dane booth are wearing. Here's a clue. It's a kippa tie. But before we get started on that, here is Suzanne Chislett a little bit later than planned with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you, Rob. American health officials are trying to contact more than 130 people who were on board a plane flown with a nurse who since tested positive for Ebola. The second person to contract the virus after treating a Liberian man in Texas flew from Cleveland to Dallas the day before, reporting symptoms. A pro-democracy protester who was apparently beaten by police in Hong Kong says he's taking legal advice. The incident, which was filmed, happened as around 45 people were arrested early this morning as authorities tried to end anti-government demonstrations. US-led forces have intensified airstrikes against Islamic State fighters threatening Kurds on Syria's Turkish border. 21 attacks have been carried out against the militants near the town of Kobani. And the Irish government has decided to close a tax loophole, which allowed multinationals to save billions of dollars. The EU and US had both criticised the structure, which had been used by companies including Apple and Google. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. It is 18:32 here at the Frieze Art Fair, the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent's Park. We're coming to you live on Monocle 24, and you can tell it's coming to you live because it sounds very live, doesn't it? We've been at Frieze Masters all day. We've been sort of chopping and changing between booths. But the man we started off with was a friend of the show. It was James Brett, who runs the Museum of Everything, and he took us on a little tour. We started off at Sam Fogg's stand and spoke to the man himself.
For me, like I say, he looks like Bagpuss, but actually he comes from high up in a church somewhere in provincial France.
James has sort of been trying to stroke him, see if he'll purr.
Yes, he didn't purr, he just bit my hand. But what I love is that it's probably some sort of folkloric carver who's local, who's been hired to do the church.
In the 12th century, that folkloric thing doesn't mean anything. You don't really have that concept of high art and low art. I think this guy also knew what he was doing. Look at the way his ears are perking up.
They poke up out of the frame.
You know, this is a clever guy. Maybe it's a lion or something like that.
And how old is this?
12th century.
Wow. And we had our eye on something else. James was wandering around your stand and he found a hot Madonna.
That's this girl here.
Okay.
That's my idea of the hot Madonna. Look at the way she swings her hips. There's a sexy girl.
Look, you've got quite a few of these pieces on offer. And there's a painting, there's a piece of iconography around the corner. That's what I thought the hot Madonna was.
The one with the goldfinch.
The one with the goldfinch. The one with the
Spraying her child with her breast milk.
Yeah.
Is it usual to see so much breast milk in an image?
Extremely unlikely. It's extremely unlikely.
I thought it was an unusual thing.
I've got a punter here, so I'm going to leave you now, but very nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Sam. We're on a different stand. We've changed places. We're looking at a Spanish Christ. In disarray, I'd have said.
This is an interesting stand. This is Feigen, and I was drawn to it because it's got a rather large amount of slightly macabre imagery on it, although classical works. And this actually comes from Richard Feigen's personal collection. And I think we should describe it. It's a weeping Christ tied to a very ornate wooden column. And the thing that makes it so gory and fascinating is the sheer number of lacerations on his body, and they're all bleeding. It's really a horrific image, but it's hyper real. And even though it's painted in the 15th century, it looks like a sort of super realism picture of, I don't know, 1970s, 1980s.
Yeah. It could almost be like a South American, like a Mexican thing. It's got that kind of detailed kind of strangeness to it. And he looks like St. Benedict. Is it St. Benedict with all the arrows?
I've never met St. Benedict. I don't know. But I do know that these tears he's got are so precise and reflecting the light. And it's just a fantastic thing. And right at the bottom, his hand is sort of coming over the frame, which is a very particular thing. We saw it also with the cat where the ears were poking up out of the carving. So obviously this was a little de rigueur.
And there's something, yeah, there's an element of it popping out of the frame at you, right?
Well, that's someone who sort of knows what he's doing, isn't quite conforming to the rules, so bending the rules where they can.
It's a beautiful thing. And should we wander on? What else has caught your eye, James? We found ourselves now at Lefebvre Fine Art. What's caught your eye here, James?
Well, I'm not usually one for fine art, but this gallery has a few things that I've always loved. They're always showing the work of Edward Burrough, who is one of my favourite artists, non-artists, although he was really in the framework. But over here, there's a rather nice, modestly carved object, slightly scary, looks a little African-esque. And in fact, it's a woman, and she was the housekeeper of Gauguin, who, as your listeners might know, was a very talented artist, also quite a naughty boy, living in the Polynesian Islands, and led what was perceived as a very debauched lifestyle with lots of girls, some of whom were of a certain age. And it just so happened there was a priest who rallied against him on the island called Père Paulin, if I'm not mistaken. And because he was a troublemaker, he decided to carve not only Monsieur Paulin, Pierre Paulin, which means Father Treachery, but also his housekeeper, who, it was alleged, was actually the priest's lover. And this is a carving of her, Thérèse, standing here very proudly on the gallery. The other one is in the Washington National Gallery, so there's no chance of getting a pair. It is a bit of a snip at 25 million, slightly beyond the Museum of Everything budget, so we've decided to pass on this one. But I highly recommend for any other museum with deeper pockets.
And it's a beautiful thing. It's the rendering of the artist's signature down the bottom left hand, that little carved PG. That's a gorgeous thing. You'd buy it for that, wouldn't you?
Nicely spotted. I also love that it's sort of gilded. Yeah. And just the, you know, what's interesting to me, honestly, is that you've got this sort of very famous artist and that actually he's being inspired by the local tradition, the carving tradition. I guess it's possible he may have had help carving this from locals. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the background. But the influence is very, very strong. And that's something I'm always interested in, is how a sort of so-called low art practice influences the high art famous makers.
Should we go and try and find some American Indians?
Well, we were talking earlier about how interesting it was that DFS has got a small stand here with some amazing early leather sofas and separates.
And World of Leather, of course, have got a lovely stand.
I actually think World of Leather is one of the best stands here. It's rumoured that it might actually win the prize.
An Office World. Don't forget Office World. Okay, so we're walking past Daniel Crouch, which is a lot of maps. Next, I'm looking at something that is raising my eyebrows, some nudes that are raising my eyebrows. What are they raising for you, James?
My eyebrows have flown over my head and are now circling around the ceiling. These are very strange, engaging, might be the adjective I choose, figurative sculptures by quite a relatively well-known artist called Reg Butler. Shall I describe them?
Yes, please.
Large, very naked, slightly disproportioned white women with staring glassy eyes and cascading golden hair pushing themselves at all of us, and they're slightly outsized, so they're a little threatening, and they're new figurative sculptures, but they seem so surreal in their attitude, don't you think?
They're strange. They're a bit like they've got a bit of John Curran about them, strange disproportionate sexiness, and I'm not sure whether they're sexy or they're not. Are you?
I find them very frightening, but I actually know the chap who sort of discovered them hidden away in a collection and was thrilled to bring them to Freeze Masters, and I questioned the good sense of that. What's very interesting is this: the largest, most strangely proportioned of them is prominently jutting out towards the restaurant, which is packed. But I don't know if I was facing her if I could really have a full plate of sushi.
I think we've got time for one more. We're going to go and see some Red Indians, I think.
Interesting that you say Red Indians. I'm never sure whether to say that. Actually, the real point is here. There was a bunch of people living in America before the Americans got here or there. And they had a culture, they had a thriving culture that was dispossessed from them. And there was very little way to record that. And some of the ethnographers went to talk to them and said, what happened when, you know, the white man came, and can you explain to us? And they didn't have so much written language, is my understanding. Visual language was used, and the ethnographers gave them paper. And here on the stand of Donald Ellis, he specializes in the images that they created, along with other works from their culture. And this one in particular has bison on all sides, and in the middle some kind of wedding ceremony or meeting between two parties. But they look like they're two different tribes to me. And these muslins used to line the interiors of the teepees. So Donald's analysis was cave painting, which I would normally steer away from. I guess the end point here is that they know who painted this. This was a very important artist in that community, and he was in his 60s when he made this work. Donald thinks it's one of the greats he's ever seen, and he's been chasing it for 15 years.
So we're looking at a bit of a holy grail here for this specific sort of art, but maybe of any art of this period.
I would say so, because it's got such substance and meaning. It's not just an image. It's something that's defining an entire nation, and a nation that doesn't exist in the same way anymore. So it's unique in that sense, but it's also a very individualized perspective of living in that society, and that makes it totally engaging.
That was James Brett from the Museum of Everything giving us a guided tour of Freeze Masters a little bit earlier on this afternoon. And who could forget that beautiful stand, that beautiful curated stand from World of Leather. We're broadcasting to you live from the Freeze Masters Art Fair in London's rainy Regent's Park. After the break, I'll speak to art critic Shana Mason about what's caught her eye at the fair, and Jim Dempsey, who's collaborating with the Thomas Dane Gallery, about why he's wearing that lovely outfit. Stay tuned.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now, or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
The UN Security Council is the roundtable heart of diplomacy that decides when to act on some of the globe's most pressing issues. But is it fit for purpose? Monocle's Steve Bloomfield paid a visit to its HQ to find out.
We blame it, we ridicule it, we say those two letters with our eyes rolled, yet we don't really understand it. We don't really stop to think why it struggles to reach an agreement. The clue is in the name, the United Nations. Since when were our nations united? And if they ever had been, would a body such as this ever need to exist?
Safe and Sound, a photographic essay now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, coming to you live from the Freeze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent's Park. The time is 18:44. I'm Robert Bound, and we've been wandering around the fair. We've been picking up some interesting friends all afternoon. We met up with the American art critic Shana Mason to see what she's enjoyed at the art fair. Has anyone got a corkscrew?
If I had a choice, I am more directed to contemporary programming, meaning after 1950, after 1960. So Hannah Wilke, literally right behind us, was one of the very first shows I ever saw when I came here to university, and that just blew me away, and it continues to do so. And then I did see a couple of the Rembrandts, you know, and also the Heli Namad booth is quite extraordinary. It's this just massive conglomerate of the, you know, stereotypical artistic genius, which it's a mythology, but it works.
It's a funny thing, and within that collection of stuff, Heli Namad worked with Norman Rosenthal, right, on this thing. And then there was a designer involved as well to put the thing together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic thing. It's kind of, I presume, riffing on the idea of an art fair itself, that you have a booth. But what do you do with it? You don't just have a white little cube. You don't just have like a workspace.
It's sterile.
It's the opposite of sterile.
Yeah.
And they really kind of had an idea and taken it for a walk. There are things alone in that collector's study, in Heli Namad's thing, that anyone would want to walk home with to deconstruct the booth and to sort of to make it. What would you take from there?
That little Picasso print that I saw, and there were literally like trays of cigarettes, and it seems like they're tchotchkes or knickknacks, but in truth, they're all elements of this collage. It would be very difficult to try and deconstruct that. You're not trying to deduce it. You know, you're not trying to rationalize the madness that you see. And that's what I think matters. You don't have to rationalize what you see. You can just take it with you. And that's what is appealing.
Yeah.
And I think that might be part of the reason why people have drifted a bit in terms of their intimacy with contemporary art. It's seemingly, as we said, sterile. It's removed, it's distanced.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? Because the contemporary fair, it should be, it's stuff that's being made now. Mm. And there's occasionally a divide between what we see and, you know, what maybe a collector is prepared to pay for something. The art on display here at Frieze Masters is everything from antiquity to presumably 1950s.
Sure.
And it's got a totally different feel, but there's an immediacy to it. We get this stuff. We get this stuff, whereas sometimes we don't get some of the contemporary stuff, right?
I don't know.
What is that? Do you feel that? Do you feel sometimes closer to something that was made 2,000 years ago than something that was made 20 years ago?
I don't know about that. It's easy for us to digest something that's been passed because we can, you know, we can write our own textbooks now that they've all been written. And to try and initiate this original dialogue about contemporary art, I have a really firm policy about writing about new work. And it applies across the board. To initiate new dialogue about contemporary art, you need to be willing to learn the language. You know, as a critic, you're almost under obligation to be able to defend anything.
There's a lot of things that I suppose, there's art that maybe becomes critic-proof by its price. This is something I've spoken to some art writers about before. Do you think that's something that's true, that something could be so taken as read, or it is worth £30 million and is by a living artist, that it becomes kind of critic-proof?
On the contrary. I mean, I think that it should withstand the criticism if it's costing that much money.
Yeah.
If it's taking a lot to produce, then, you know, the critic should be even more forthcoming. But I think what's happening now is a lot of criticism about contemporary art is becoming angrier, not more critical. For a critic, their writing is their art. I've always felt that way about critics like Rosalind Krauss, like David Levi Strauss, like Hal Foster, and even newer critics for the New York Times, like Holland Cotter, like Roberta Smith, and Jerry Saltz. They have crafted writing about art into an art all on its own to become approachable, and they need to be able to absorb those type of works for a larger audience. They're not just writing for a 1%.
So this is, you're talking about like very specific sort of niche art publications. You're talking about this sort of thing. We're in the world of Frieze Masters today, Sian, and so we're talking about a lot of work that has sort of passed into the canon, if you know what I mean.
True.
So it's kind of, you read across and you see the name of the artist, you look at the painting, then you maybe see the price or you ask the dealer for the price, but you know all the time that it's kind of been accepted into the club of the canon of art, right? That's I guess what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
Does that make it for you, does it make it maybe a less challenging show? Should it be challenging at all? Let's face it, all of this stuff is for sale.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that you can buy it sometimes lessens its challenge. Something that's not out of reach somehow makes it more valuable.
It's an interesting thing. We can maybe end on this. Is that thing we talked about, the sort of 50 shades of grey that are in the Frieze palette, right? And we're in a sort of very much a kind of battleship grey corner of Frieze Masters here. there's almost like church lighting. It's like you would use this lighting to light iconography in a church. We're doing it to mark out some modern masters, some ancient stuff. But it's that same thing. There's a kind of ecclesiastical reverence to the display of a lot of this work, isn't
and
there?
In Grice's opinion in the essay, that lessens the value of the work. It makes you believe in something. It gives you this type of defeat, this self-defeat, this shock and awe.
Yeah.
Terminologies interchangeable here. but this work is less approachable because of its stature. But that, see, to a critic, it should be a challenge.
Shock and awe. That was contemporary art critic Shana Mason. Stay tuned to this special edition of Midori House coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent Park, where it is 18:50 in the evening, because we're using a 24-hour clock. It's 18:50, period. Coming up next, we're going to have John Corbett from Corbett versus Dempsey Gallery to talk us through his lovely booth. Stay tuned.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London,
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Essa é a Mônaco 24.
From London,
in London,
London, cara.
De Londres.
Esto es Mônaco 24.
All right, Frieze Masters, London's Regent's Park. I'm Robert Bound. We're coming to you live. It's Mônaco 24, and I'm joined by the wonderfully dressed John Corbett. He's one half of Corbett versus Dempsey, who are also teamed up with the Thomas Dane Gallery, who maybe our listeners will also know from London. Now, John, welcome to the programme.
Pleasure to be here.
And you've got a lovely booth. You're just really a couple of booths up from our radio booth here at Frieze Masters. Talk us through the concept and whether or not you and the Thomas Dane Gallery make happy bedfellows. First of all, how's it like collaborating with another gallery?
Well, it's the third time that we've done Frieze Masters, each time with Thomas Dane Gallery. And it's been great every time. It's been
so you're
different
happy
every time.
The bed is worn in, the sheets are dirty.
Bed is, yes, all havoc has been wrought. Yeah. No, we're having a great time, and it's always different. And this time we did something really, for me, very interesting, a learning process, which is we thought, let's set the booth in 1974, so 40 years ago, and think what would the two galleries, neither of which was
existed
formed
back then. Right? Yeah.
I was 11. François Chantalat from Thomas Dane Gallery was born that year. So we thought, what would we be if we projected ourselves back interested in at that time? And what we discovered, which we didn't know to begin with, was we would have been interested in West Coast American work. That would have been a big thing. And we went search for our stuff that we each wanted and came back to the table with a lot of Bay Area funk and a lot of 1960s and early 70s work from Los Angeles.
And it's a sort of fascinating, slightly solipsistic thing to do, to kind of go, I wonder what I've always been great, but I wonder how great I'd have been when I was a young boy, or even just an embryo, or even just a glint in the milkman's eye, right?
That's true. Well, it's there's no place better than to beat your own chest than an art fair.
Okay, yeah. And so talk us through some of the things you've got on your walls. It's a beautifully put together booth. I don't know how you do that thing of not having too much, but just having enough. Obviously, you're here to sell, but you want it to look as beautiful as possible. How much discussion is done about what goes where, or do you just kind of play it by ear when you've got the works here?
There's a lot of discussion, and then generally you throw all of that out when you actually get into it and you improvise. And you've got anchor pieces that you're building around, so you know this will be here or that will be there. But then figuring out what the other kinds of relationships are is a fluid process. We set it up so that it would be like it was 1974, and we had a gallery space, and then in the back of the gallery space is the office. And so we have an office that's really sort of much more densely hung, and there are shelves and there are objects on the shelves, and there's a little bit of ephemera there. And in the gallery space, it's more open and it's a little bit sparer and a little bit more fussy in a way, which is sort of how we wanted to pitch it, so you'd have both sides of that.
And do these gallerists that existed in 1974, do they have a similar sort of persona and taste to you guys? I mean, like, can you definitely see, can you sort of go back to the future and trace yourselves in the works that are on the walls in your booth?
I think so. I mean, it's we're both also historically minded galleries, so in a way, it's this is work we're interested in now. Also, what we did decide was that what we would not be interested in, which is as interesting to us as what we would be, was work from the 40s and 50s. That would be seen passé and horrible and gauche. So there's nothing like that. But there is a work from 1910, which is an oddball piece from 1910, which is shows, I think, for us this kind of interest in the historical antecedents of the oddballs that we're interested in now. So for, in a way, that was as interesting. Let's figure out what we would have avoided.
And we promised our listeners that you guys were going to be kind of dressed in kipper ties and flares and stuff, like people from 1974. I got that wrong, didn't I? I mean, it's not like I want my money back, John. But,
well,
I mean, I
we
might
did
have made
think
an effort.
I'm 51 years old, and I've never had a mustache.
Okay, so I do now,
and that's because of this fair. My wife is very angry.
So that you're getting into the role.
You're getting
into your idiom.
We didn't want to wear wide lapels. It wasn't American Hustle. It was sort of, let's try and set this in a way that's more, that the work is where that's at. And now that we're here, I'm really glad, because across from us is a booth that's very deep in that.
Yeah.
And we would have looked, they would have mopped us up if we had actually tried to costume ourselves, because their whole booth is costumed.
And has it led to an interesting discussion between you and Francois, particularly, like, about, well, what you might have been like back then, and really, if you could have bought this, if you could have attended this thing? Presumably Art Cologne was the only art fair back in 1974, wasn't it? Oh.
Well, it is very interesting to me. So we brought with us an Arneson sculpture, so a beautiful ceramic by one of the great American ceramicists. And they brought two works by John Outerbridge, who was a Los Angeles African-American artist who was working largely in metal at the time, but also made these beautiful fetish dolls. We had a guy come into the booth who was around in LA at the time,
okay,
and he said, here's the funny thing. At that time, Arneson would have been the superstar, and people were ignoring Outerbridge. Now it's completely flipped.
So that's the strange thing when you look down the sort of down the other end of the telescope,
yep,
don't you? And it's one of those things. I interviewed someone this morning, and they were saying, "Well, it's strange. When you look at an auction catalogue from 20 years ago maximum, you will not be able to believe the prices paid for some of this stuff, and vice versa." But being at Masters gives you, I mean, you kind of, as I said earlier, everything kind of gets, the box has been ticked. Everything is kind of in the canon of art, right?
Yep.
But it's just maybe the reputations have been switched around between some of the artists you're showing.
Yeah, and you have to, you know, I love the Arneson as much as anything in the booth.
Yeah.
So I think you have to draw those conclusions for yourself, and you have to stick to your guns in terms of what it is. We're not a market-driven program, and neither is Dane.
Yeah.
We're aware of what's going on in the market, but we stick to what we want to do and what we've done. And those interests have fueled the contemporary side of both of our programs, because although we show at Masters and we have a historical angle, we also show contemporary art, and that's so making those links and sustaining them is important.
Okay, well, we've got to wind it up there, John. That's a bit of a shame. And before we should let anyone listening to this radio program live from the fair, I think they've got a couple of hours to go and raid your whiskey cabinet. And I'm right in inviting everyone around, right?
Oh yeah, we have plenty.
John Corbett, thank you very much for talking us through the Corbett versus Dempsey Thomas Dane collaboration that's successful now, as it was 3 years ago in its first incarnation. Thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thanks to all my guests here at Frieze Masters. Today's show was produced by Holly Fisher. It was researched by Gaia Lutz. Our studio manager here was Bill Luty, and back in the studio at Midori House was Chris Chilvers. Thank you once again, Tom Edwards, for playing barman. If you still haven't had your Frieze Phil, then join me for Culture next Monday night, and we'll be recapping on all the fun of the fair. Next off the news headlines, Danny Giacopelli will be here for The Entrepreneurs and our weekly business show. But for me, I'll get it out. For me, Robert Bound, I'd like to thank you all for tuning in.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.